This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In, where we touch on a bunch of different Indiana-related topics throughout the hour. Later, we'll hear about the new Shining a Light installation on Indianapolis's Monument Circle, which will show its first display tomorrow night. We'll also talk about the election with our Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith in a little bit. But first, it's time to catch up on the week's biggest headlines throughout the state with Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad. So we'll talk about the election, too, namely school referendums here at the top.
I mean, it's referenda.
Well, okay. So our producer, Drew, looked it up, and he says it's referendums, and he's very detail-oriented. And so I'm going to side with him.
I always hesitate to tell Drew that he's wrong because it's usually losing battle. That being said, it's absolutely referenda, but Latin is dead for a reason, and that's fine.
So what happened with these ballot initiatives?
Yeah, so the pass rate was actually only 53%, so a little bit less than half of the 13 proposed referenda were passed.
Oof.
Which is the lowest since 2014. What's interesting is that districts that had previously passed a referendum passed with 80%, but first-timers, folks who are putting these ballot initiatives on for the first time, only passed with 38%. Out of the 13, eight of those were first-timers and five had previously passed.
Okay, so what passed and what didn't? Where are we looking?
Yeah, so Scott County, number one, passed the largest referenda referendum at 90 cents per $100 of assessed value.
I was wondering how that one was going to go.
Yeah, it was the largest one, and it passed pretty significantly. So they ended up shaking out really well for themselves. But other communities like Washington and Center Grove Community Schools failed to win voter approval for their measures. But Carmel Clay, for example, which was the state's first ever school safety referendum, also claimed victory for theirs. And so did Zionsville Community Schools. So a lot of the referenda that was requesting for school safety and things like that, building operation stuff, that all seemed to do pretty well. But in essence, it was kind of a modgepodge of results, a little bit hit or miss.
I'm sure we could talk about the way it was worded and the way it was campaigned and things like that. But you said just over 50%.
53%.
Is that considered good or bad or in between?
So ironically enough, that's kind of typical for a November referendum.
Okay.
Referenda historically do way better in May than they do in November because you're getting more excited voters who are showing up to the ballot box, as opposed to people who vote in a general election because they feel like they have to vote in a general election or are more apathetic about these particular issues. So May referenda seem to do a lot better than November. But yeah, as on the whole, it was kind of typical, except for that pass rate, which, again, is the lowest since 2014. Mm-hmm. So that was the one that seemed to turn heads a little bit more.
The Scott County one really surprises me because that's a pretty rural district, right? And a lot of farmers out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're typically opposed to the way that this works because they have a lot of land and would therefore be paying the biggest price. And that is a big... That was a lot of money down there on that one in Scott County.
Definitely. I mean, I built a calculator, actually, specifically for this purpose.
Of course you did.
I built a calculator for everyone to be able to look these up. but for $100,000 of assessed home value, assuming that it's a homestead in Scott County, you're seeing an additional property tax of $324.79.
Wow.
And that's, not including any additional deductions, but as the highest mark, it's going to be more than $300 extra. And Scott County voters said, yeah, no, let's do this for our schools.
Let's talk about a different ballot initiative. This one in Vigo County, having to do with the proposed casino.
Yes. So there's a little bit of a history to this. Of course, during the 2019 legislative session, a bill that was passed that made, quote, seismic shifts to Indiana's gaming industry, including online and mobile sports betting, and approving a new casino in Vigo County. So the Indiana Gaming Commission gave their approval for this in August, at the very end of August, but voters needed to approve this casino as well, and they did, with more than 60% of the vote. The Gaming Commission is accepting bids until December 1st for proposals, so that's winding down right now. But so far, two casino companies have expressed interest in the project, with one touting a project of at least $100 million that would have 300 to 400 workers. So they're looking at this as a huge economic boom, and that's kind of splitting people's opinions as to whether or not you should or shouldn't have a new casino in Vigo County.
All right. And let's look at District 1 and the retirement of a longtime congressman up there, Pete Visklosky. How long was he serving District 1?
He announced that he was not running for re-election on the 35th anniversary of his election to the U.S. Congress.
So so this is kind of a big deal up there.
It's a very big deal.
To say the least.
To say the very least, yeah. You know, Visklosky is the elder statesman. Andre Carson, for Democrats, is the only other Democrat that's currently serving in the House of Representatives for Indiana. And Carson's only been in office since 2008. So that's a lot of institutional knowledge that the Democratic delegation is losing very quickly.
Is this a reliably blue district?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, without question. Like, we're not going to get any surprises next November?
Visklosky won his election in 2018 by more than 30 points, percentage points.
Well, I wonder how much of that has to do with it being him.
I mean, that's a fairly consistently blue area, no matter what. I mean, it's true for state representatives and state senators. It's true for a little bit of everything. Like, that is a very consistently blue area. It's not a lot of Republicans just don't necessarily win in that area.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about his retirement when we speak with Brandon Smith later this hour. But let's move on to Indiana's drug czar, Jim McClelland. What did we hear about him this week?
He's also retiring. Everyone's retiring this week. And for some reason, I'm the one writing those web stories this week because I volunteer myself. But yeah, Jim McClelland, he's Indiana's drug czar. He announced that he's retiring this week. He actually came out of retirement in order to serve in this position in 2017 when Governor Holcomb wrote an executive order essentially establishing that job in the first place in a department specifically focused on Indiana's drug epidemic. McClelland came out of retirement after serving as the CEO and president of Goodwill Industries of Central Indiana. And now he's heading back to retirement, and he seems very excited about it. But even in the comments that he gave during the Indiana Commission the Drug Abuse Commission. Even in his comments during that, he said, you know what, like, we've done a lot of really great work. We've already done a lot of really great work fighting the drug epidemic, but we have so much more to do. And so he's being replaced by his deputy, Doug Hunsinger, who's served in the same position as just underneath him for 3 years.
And regarding public or peer opinion of him, does everyone pretty much agree that he did a decent job during his tenure?
Yeah. McClelland's not... I wouldn't call Jim McClelland a controversial figure by any stretch of the imagination. He's really led the way on Indiana's response to the drug crisis, and especially figuring out how to, you know, build partnerships with businesses, you know, working with even trying to talk to businesses about how to get drug recovery into insurance plans and things like that. So he's looked at it from a very holistic standpoint and hasn't really told anyone to take anything off the table. And I think that's the reason people have liked him so far.
Let's move on to another big story this week. This one out of Indianapolis. Indianapolis Motor Speedway was sold for the first time in 74 years?
74 years. Hallman & Co. announced Monday that it has entered an agreement with Penske Corporation to sell the company's operating assets, including the racetrack, the IndyCar series, and IMS Productions.
This is a huge deal.
It is bonkers huge. Yes.
So what does Holman and Company even have now? They sold Clabber Girl, what, last year or the year before?
Year before, I think.
And now they've sold IndyCar, essentially, mm-hmm. plus the track. Do they just have a pile of money now or what?
I think they kind of just have a pile of money now. assuming that this deal goes through, there are a couple of things that have to be negotiated down the line. But yeah, I think they'll just have a pile of money for the most part. During the press conference, Tony George, who's the chairman of Hallman & Company, said that he wanted to stay around racing. And Roger Penske, during that same press conference, had made comment about wanting to keep him in the loop if he's not the owner, still wanting to keep him involved. So they'll be around.
And as I understand it, they also have a race team still, the Holman family. And so what does this mean for the track leadership? Do we know if anything's going to get shuffled around?
Yeah. So Roger Penske, during that press conference, said that he didn't have like a gymnasium full of people to replace the infrastructure that the Holman company had already set up. So he was like, hey, you know what? As far as I'm concerned, I want to keep the leadership in place and make changes to how we think about the racetrack. And he was really pushing about rethinking the Speedway as an entertainment venue, in addition to all of the races that are obviously at the 500.
Which has really kind of been somewhat of a recent thing for the track. I mean, the track has really only hosted a limited number of events throughout the year, and up until the early 90s, only hosted one event per year.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty significant. And Roger Penske is a man who likes to make money. And so I can't imagine anything being any different.
Exactly. I mean, it's a 1,000 acre property. So they've got so much space. They've got so much that they could be doing with that space. And I think Penske's really interested in figuring out how to test those limits and see exactly where they can go from there.
This isn't going to give Team Penske an edge at the track or in IndyCar, is it?
Not so far. he addressed some of those rumors during that press conference. But most of the team owners were like, hey, you know what? This is amazing. This is great. And Penske's response was mostly, no one's going to let me like make an edge for myself. So there's a self-regulating industry, and the team owners seemed really excited for him on Twitter.
She's the finest digital producer in all the land, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, more on some of the surprising election results from around the state. Republicans picked up a record number of mayoral seats in Indiana, but it was the Democratic wins that soaked up most of the media spotlight. We'll find out why with State House reporter Brandon Smith. Next, I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. This past Tuesday was Election Day across Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith joins us today to recap what happened, what the results were, and what insight we can gain looking to future races. Brandon, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
So Monday night, on the eve of Election Day, an error crashed the BMV's system. What happened, and how does this tie into the elections?
We don't know exactly what happened yet. What we do know is that it involved a private vendor. They have a private company, a global firm that handles their credentialing, so like with IDs and things like that. And something happened with that system that crashed the BMV statewide. You couldn't do anything at a branch. You couldn't go online, really. You couldn't go into any of their kiosks that they have set up. And that started about 4 in the afternoon on Monday. And the reason that tied into the election is that the BMV has extended hours both Monday and Tuesday before and of Election Day, because you need ID to vote in Indiana. Pretty famously, Indiana has a voter ID law. And so if you needed to get an ID to go vote, there was a question as to whether or not that was going to be possible. Now, fortunately, about 5:40-something in the morning on Tuesday, on Election Day, the BMV was able to get their system back up and running just before they opened, at the same time that polls opened, 6 a.m., so that was back available for any Hoosier that needed it.
Wow, pretty close. I mean, I was going to say it didn't seem to affect the card reader at my polling place.
No.
Completely different problem.
Completely different system, completely different problem. Now, you had to get the ID from the BMV first, and that was the problem you were having. But fortunately, they got it solved just in time.
All right. So it was corrected, and the voters headed out to the polls. Before we get into specific races, can you give us the broad strokes? What trends did we see on Tuesday?
Hard to nail down a specific trend. I think both parties had something that they could kind of crow about after Tuesday night. The Republicans picked up a lot of mayor's races across the state, the most they've ever had, in fact, 70 total statewide. And that's obviously a big deal in terms of geographic spread. There wasn't any like pocket where they did well more than any other. But at the same time, Democrats had huge surges in both in the two biggest cities in Indiana, Indianapolis and Fort Wayne. And they scored some really shocking and significant upsets in central Indiana. So there were things that both parties could talk about that they were really positive coming out of Tuesday night.
Let's go back to the GOP and their 70 mayoral seats. Is this a surprising uptick? It's the most ever.
Yes and no. I mean, if you look at sort of the national political trend over the last couple of years, in response in part to President Trump, Democrats have had a lot more success recently in a lot of other states. And so you're tempted to look at that all across the country and go, well, yet here in Indiana, Republicans did better than they've ever done before. But the caveat here is that local races are local races, and you can only read so much of the national political headwinds into them. You never know what's going to influence a race in a town of 20,000 people. For example, not that these are towns of 20,000 people, but in Muncie, one of the seats where a Democrat lost an election, that's been a city hall that's been beset by controversy and FBI investigations and things like that. Similar thing in Michigan City, where a Democrat incumbent lost, not by very much, but that Democratic incumbent had been indicted on multiple felony counts a week before the election. Now, we don't know if he's guilty or not, but that's enough that it probably turned the result, certainly. So did that have anything to do with Donald Trump or the federal government or Congress or anything like that? Absolutely not. So a lot of times with local races, you hesitate to say it's part of a larger or national trend because local races are, at their very core, local.
Any other interesting mayoral races across the state?
Oh, there's always a few interesting ones, but those are the two that stuck out in terms of easily identifiable reasons why something pretty shocking happened in that sense, with two Democratic relative strongholds flipping to Republicans. But there's always surprises. One longtime political operative told me that it doesn't matter what party, you always plan to win some and lose some, and you never quite know which that's going to be because that's just the way local races go.
And Democrats saw a few victories in interesting places. Let's start with the Columbus City Council, which caught some national attention. What happened there?
Well, this is another and perhaps one of the best cases for why you should vote and why your vote counts, especially in local elections. So Democrats hadn't controlled the Columbus City Council, which is famously home to Vice President Mike Pence, as well as his brother, Greg, who's a congressman now. The home of Mike Pence, Democrats hadn't controlled the city council there since the early 80s. And they got a majority in Tuesday's election by a single vote.
Wow.
One of those Democratic members that put them over the top for the majority won by a single vote, barring any recounts or anything like that. At this moment, what we know is that they won by a single vote. So a single vote decided the political balance of the Columbus City Council.
What, has there been any reaction to that locally or even, I mean, nationwide we got coverage on that?
It's the latest, but it's not the only example in Indiana of a close margin or statewide in a close margin. I mean, last time out, I believe the Virginia House of Delegates, they had to draw a name out of a bowl because everything else was tied. And that decided that Republicans controlled the Virginia House of Delegates.
Wow.
So, I mean, if you needed more evidence, the Columbus City Council races are another example of why your vote matters.
There was another close one. We saw Democrat Emily Styron unseat Zionsville Mayor Tim Hawk by 88 votes. Were these close races sort of a trend across the state, or are those two isolated incidents?
They're isolated incidents in so much as you can't ever read too much. And like I said, with local races, you never quite know what it's going to be. In my hometown, which is Lawrence, Indiana, which is sort of part of Indianapolis and sort of not, the mayor's race was decided by less than 200 votes out of thousands cast. But that Zionsville race for my money, was the one that surprised me the most of any race in Indiana on election night. There are some others that we're going to talk about in a second that surprised me too, for obvious reasons, but that not only that a Democrat won in Zionsville, because that's pretty darn shocking.
That is pretty significant.
But that she defeated an incumbent with no obvious problems. We just talked about Muncie and Michigan City as being like, oh, well, there's extenuating circumstances there that would really help explain that. There's nothing here. Tim Hawk had no obvious controversies or scandals or anything like that. She just beat him. A Democrat just beat an incumbent Republican in Zionsville. That blew my mind.
Albeit narrowly. All right, let's talk about South Bend. Is Mayor Pete technically no longer Mayor Pete?
No, he's still Mayor Pete for just a little longer.
Just a little longer, yeah.
So the new mayor to replace him, who was sort of handpicked, if you will, by Pete. He's long time been a Buttigieg advisor, and so it was kind of the heir apparent, if you will. He was running as a, well, if you liked Mayor Pete, we're going to keep on doing what we're doing here. He'll officially be sworn in relatively soon, I think. And that'll be when Mayor Pete becomes former Mayor Pete. But although those folks usually hold on to their honorifics even after they've left office.
So do you see maybe Mayor Pete taking a political hit because of that? Or is this just because this is just what happens?
This is just what happened. I mean, he made the decision that he wasn't going to be running for president, actively running for president and also running for mayor. So actually, I would argue he would take more blowback if he'd tried to stay mayor of South Bend, which he would have won, certainly. While also running for president.
Fair enough. Hamilton County now. What happened here?
Yeah, that was the other surprising results I talked about. So Carmel has been a city since 1874. I looked it up. It was incorporated in 1874. And basically, since it was incorporated, they've never had a Democrat elected to the city council.
Never.
Never. As far as I could find, they've never had a Democrat elected to city council. Certainly not in living memory. That changed Tuesday night. And that combined with races in Fishers. So Fishers is the town just east, next to and east of Carmel. That it's a much newer city with a much newer government, but they never really had Democrats elected there either. Two Democrats were elected to their council on Tuesday night. That's really significant, both for those communities themselves, but also for what it tells us about Hamilton County in general. We've been hearing this narrative building for a while, and for a while I mean like a year or two, that Hamilton County's demographics are changing. It's one of the fastest growing counties in Indiana, and a lot of that seems to be folks coming from Indianapolis and Marion County moving up north into Carmel and Fishers, particularly Fishers. And with that is a changing electorate. And we saw that reflected in Joe Donnelly's numbers in the 2018 Senate race, where he didn't win, and he didn't win Hamilton County, but that margin was a lot closer than it was 6 years earlier when Joe Donnelly ran in 2012. And that's part of this growing belief by Democrats that Hamilton County is changing. It's not this Republican stronghold that it's always been. Will it still go to Republicans next year? Probably. But will it be a lot closer? It certainly seems that way, and that could have an effect on a federal race.
The Republican stronghold that Hamilton County is always – I mean, it doesn't surprise me, but when I lived there, and I lived in Noblesville in the early 2010s, I went and voted in the midterm in 2010, and there was someone sitting outside the polling place who said, you know, do you know who you're voting for today? And, you know, we said, you know, I'm not going to tell you. And she said, we'd appreciate your Republican vote. And I thought – do you really feel like you need to do that in Hamilton County?
For the longest time, you didn't. I mean, a lot of times you didn't even find Democrats on the ballot. Like the Hamilton County Democratic Party, as much as there was one, often had trouble even fielding candidates, let alone candidates who would actually put on a real campaign. That is very clearly changing. It has been for a little while, but we're starting to see those results pay off. I mean, things are changing in Hamilton County. Republicans know it and Democrats know it. Have they completely changed yet? No. But these races from Tuesday night just add more fuel to the fire of the changing winds, if I'm going to mix metaphors here, of Hamilton County.
And some suggest we could see ripple effects from these races into the 5th congressional district race. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. I think that's part of it. So the 5th congressional district is Susan Brooks's. She announced she was retiring a little earlier this year. She wasn't going to run again. And that really amped up the sort of furor over this race. But before she even retired, this was a race that Democrats at the federal level, at the national level, were targeting because it's a suburban seat. And as we've seen all across the country in 2018, in a little bit of 2016, but 2018 and now, Democrats are targeting the suburbs of major cities, and this is a major city, for pickup. Longtime Republican strongholds that are weakening and falling apart. I don't think Indiana's 5th district is falling apart as fast as others we've seen around the country, but it's clearly one that they're targeting, and they were targeting it before Susan Brooks decided to leave. Now that she has, it makes it even more attractive for Democrats to try to pick up. And we've seen there are three Democrats running for that seat right now. I believe there are 7 Republicans who are running. So this could be one of the most watched races. It'll almost certainly be the most watched race in Indiana next year. It might be one of the most watched races in the country.
With the announcement of Congressman Visklosky's retirement, This means that there will be 2 open congressional seats come 2020 in Indiana. Are these races going to look entirely different from one another?
Very, very much so. The Democratic race, or the race up in the first district that I just Freudian slipped called a Democratic race, will be decided in the primary. Pete Visklosky, despite his status as an incumbent, that is a very safe Democratic seat. It will not go. I mean, I can, as much as I don't like to be definitive about anything in this job, that race is not going to be won by a Republican. Not even Republicans think that. It's the way they've purposely drawn it. Draw safe, really consolidated Democratic districts so there's more Republican seats. That's the way it was intended when they drew the maps a few years ago. Pete Visklosky retiring sets up what could be a really fun primary next May for his replacement, because there are already 2 or 3 candidates who've said they are interested in running or said they are going to run. A mayor up there, a council member up there, as well as a state representative who said she's exploring it. So that'll be decided in the primary, and then the general election will be an afterthought. Whereas the 5th district race will be both a fun primary and a fun general election.
Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Turning from municipal elections to a different kind of ballot, the results of the 2019 Best of Indiana People's Choice campaign were released on Monday. Hoosiers from across the state voted on the best breweries, hiking trails, main streets, and more. Joining us today to share where we can find the best of the best in Indiana is Misty Weisensteiner, the director of Indiana Office of Tourism Development. Misty, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's wonderful to share information about Indiana, especially this.
And the people have spoken. Every year, Visit Indiana invites Hoosiers to vote on the best in the state. So how many people ended up voting?
Oh, my gosh. It was a record-breaking year. I believe 45,000 people voted this year, which is outrageous. We did break records of the number of votes. So people are passionate about what their favorite things are here in Indiana.
So let's get going and hear about the results. Let's start with Best Brewery. Who took the top spot from Best Brewery?
Well, you know, we had 50 breweries for people to choose from, and the winner was Bad Dad Brewing Company in Fairmont.
My wife works in the beer industry, and I'd never heard of Bad Dad Brewery.
Isn't that an awesome name?
I suppose.
I love it. And their beer list is quite interesting, the names, too. I think it has something to do with, tube socks or socks and sandals, you know, just clicky names about bad dads and family. And it's just really awesome. And it is a family affair. They have a great restaurant attached to them, too, which has wonderful pizza, I have been told. So that's definitely on my to-do list to check out.
Yeah, I'll have to head up there and do the same. All right. Hiking trails. This is what I'm interested in very much. So, I mean, I like beer, too. Indiana offers more than 3,600 miles of local, state, federal, and nonprofit trails open to the public. I have my favorite spots, of course, but what location took the crown this year?
You know, I love outdoor activities and hiking too. Turkey Run State Park, trail number 3, was the winner.
Oh, what a great one. Good call, Indiana.
And they captured the number 1 and number 2 spot. So Turkey Run is definitely a favorite among our voters.
Any other spots that were popular or maybe worth checking out? I'm mostly just asking for myself.
Right. Clifty Falls down in southern Indiana. I don't know if you've been there.
Many times. I love Clifty Falls.
I do too. So trail number two was our third place winner.
Ah, good choice. And lastly, best Main Street. This really gets to the heart of a lot of towns. I bet there were a lot of great contenders. How did you decide who would even be on the roster for Main Street?
Well, we really went to Okra, which is the leader in the Main Streets, and they do the accreditation program and really help the communities develop their Main Streets, give them guidance. So they gave us a list, and the winner this year was Franklin in Johnson County.
Oh, Franklin, Indiana. Very, very nice. And what made Franklin so great? Why did people say they liked it so much?
Well, I guess they've made some real significant changes to the downtown over the past few years. They've had a lot of new businesses come in, restaurants and shops. It's very walkable downtown, which resulted in a lot of activities and festivals, beautiful Victorian mansions. It's just a beautiful, quaint, just whenever you think of a Main Street, that's what comes to mind. It's the picture-perfect Main Street.
Misty Weisensteiner, the director of Indiana Office of Tourism Development, thank you so much for chatting with us. You can find the full list of results for this year's Best of Indiana campaign, as well as years past, at visitindiana.com. Misty, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
And up next, a big gift from Lilly Endowment gives Indianapolis's Monument Circle a patriotic light show. Not once, not twice, but every single night from here on out. What is it? How did they land on what to do? And how will it improve the circle when the show's not being put on? We'll talk to Bob Schultz, Senior VP of Marketing and Communications for Indy Downtown Inc., about tomorrow night's debut of Shining a Light on the Circle. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds. This is All In.
This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. After tomorrow, Indianapolis's Monument Circle will look a little different. A $7.6 million lighting, audio, and projection display is going in that will, every night at dusk, put on a patriotic show. And here with the details, our Senior Vice President of Marketing and Communications for Downtown Indy, Inc., Bob Schultz. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Matt. How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Good.
This, my intro that I just did will not do it justice, and neither will our discussion that we're going to have here. So people are going to need to see it for themselves. But there will be plenty of opportunities to do so, namely every single evening.
Every night. That's right.
So what is this? What's it going to look and sound like?
Well, here we have the cultural and geographical hub of our city, of our state, Monument Circle. Whether you're from any part of the state, you know it's the center of downtown. And it's a beautiful space. It's this monument, the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, which pays tribute to Indiana veterans near and far, has been in place since 1902, but it is woefully lit after dark. It's just never had a good presentation after dark. And so we've also seen when it has been appropriately lit, and honestly, that was during the Super Bowl and recently when we taped American Ninja Warriors. And so we know that what beautiful light can do to a space after dark. Meanwhile, we also know that it tells the story of Indiana veterans, and not just the history of such, but it pays tribute to those who are currently serving or have recently served. And so we partnered with the Indiana War Memorials Commission when Lilly Endowment invited nonprofit organizations to consider infusing more arts and culture into our community. And we thought of this iconic center of our city, Monument Circle, where we come to celebrate, we come to mourn, we come to remember, we come to put on events. And why not bring more energy to this space, especially after dark, and use the entire circle, not just the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, but the entire circle as a theater to pay tribute to veterans and to honor what Lilly Endowment was trying to accomplish by the infusion of more arts and culture. It's where we gather, and you don't need a ticket to attend. And that's what's beautiful about Monument Circle.
Has something like this been done anywhere else?
Not to the extent that we're doing it on a building, a solid structure every night of the year. And so we see that. And we're talking about a presentation that, you know, when you come down for it, the lead in from 10-minute countdown, a 5-minute presentation, some music and all of this, it's not going to, you know, be an all night thing as far as the video component of this. But it's the amazing light that is being able to be cast upon that Soldiers and Sailors Monument. We're adding an audio system that I haven't even heard to the its fullest extent, and not just to overpower people with light and sound, but to add this texture, to be able to add the sound element with patriotic music. It all premieres tomorrow night with the governor on the Circle, and we'll get to all see it for the first time. I saw some testing this week, and your description at the front end of the conversation and my own description to my family, it just doesn't do it justice. And this is spectacular. Think of video that is 16 stories high.
Wow.
That will be played out, video mapping, which means they can open these buildings. You've seen it probably on Cinderella's Castle, or you see it on some of the great buildings across our country up in the Merchant Mart in Chicago, where it looks like it's falling into itself. And what we've recreated is this, if you've been to the Indiana War Memorial, it's the Shrine Room, which is this cavernous space, and these flags unfurl, and all the branches of the military, and these components. We had a score written by the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. Actually, it was written by John Colby, a Grammy Award-winning composer, and then charted and recorded by the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, which is this patriotic ballad that these flags unfurl, and as four beats crescendo, a spotlight from each segment of the Circle illuminates and crisscrosses over Victory to light what we know as the Crossroads of America. And all this will happen every night, and then the uplighting around the surrounding buildings add this texture and this feel of the space that is patriotic, but not Kings Island, not Vegas. This is not an over-the-top show. This is a patriotic salute, and one you walk away with saying, hey, I'm glad we're doing this in our community.
So a 5-minute show every night.
Yes, sir.
But let's talk about some of the utilitarian improvements as well that are going to happen to Monument Circle. You said that it's been woefully lit for a long time.
That's
it took
right.
The Super Bowl, which is understandable, and also American Ninja Warrior to kind of coax it to its sort of fullest expression, lighting-wise. And this will be more of a permanent improvement. What else will be done infrastructure-wise to the Circle? How is it being improved for all of the other hours of the day when this presentation is not going to be happening?
So during the daylight, obviously the biggest thing you'll notice differently is the sound system. So you hear the soundtrack that'll play. We eventually can get to the point where maybe a story is being told, you know, like noon every Saturday, and it might be lead people through a little tour. This is the dreaming is not stopping as we launch this week.
There's a lot you can do with all this stuff.
There's amazing. And, you know, think about what Lilly Endowment has done for our Central Indiana community. And they believed in us and have invested in our community. And we want to pay that justice. And so that element of sound, which we have seen on Georgia Street after the Super Bowl, during and after the Super Bowl, we see in other communities this soft, patriotic sound during the holiday season. You come down there and, you know, the snow is softly falling and you have the holiday music playing. It just adds to this sense of community that we are having a shared experience in this most iconic center part of our city. And so the sound element, we've also have a new temporary stage that we can set up and take down and put on performances. We're going to go into, you know, many people know about the Circle of Lights the night after Thanksgiving. That will be spectacular with this video and lighting elements added to it. But then every Saturday between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we'll have, you know, holidays on the Circle with performances out there on this small stage, leading, you know, late afternoon, going into evening, again, seeing a moment that we can pay tribute to why that space exists to honor our veterans, but then also go into that holiday experience as well.
So a lot of money coming from Lilly Endowment, $7.6 million. A lot of people, a lot of moving parts, figuratively and literally. But whose idea was this? How did this get started?
So, you know, we'd have to go back to, you know, the late 1900s when or actually late 1800s, late 19th century, when this space was created and when the Soldiers and Sailors Monument was erected. And this competition is a worldwide competition to build this monument to the war heroes of those returning to war or from war in Indiana, in this center city with the Indiana War Memorials Commission, the Soldiers and Sailors Monument has so many stories on itself to begin with. So you go back to this space as well, right? So we think about that, and then over the years, additional monuments. You know, Indianapolis is second only to D.C. with a number of monuments or memorials to our war and military history. And Indiana per capita has brought more people into the National Guard and into armed conflicts than any other state in the Union per capita. So you think about this, and we recognize that already on the circle. Now, fast forward, and we have some of us who want to be a little bit more on the marketing and special event space that we think of. Pre-Super Bowl, think about going after the 2012 Super Bowl in 2008. Team and visitors, or I guess our local organizing committee, started thinking, how can we do something spectacular on the circle? Well, it didn't make sense to fund it for just a week-long activation. This is not a cheap endeavor. The video content that's necessary, the infrastructure, the 240,000 lumen projectors that need to be in place to project this kind of image 200 yards across the circle onto a building facade. All of this is in place now. And so that dream began before the Super Bowl, and it led, you know, when we saw more and more conversation happening. And then we did this, and I say we, Downtown Indy Inc., did this downtown survey called Velocity, where we looked at what are the priorities for downtown. And the overwhelming conversation was, how can we activate our public spaces more and more? The people want places to have the accidental connections with others and connectedness. And Monument Circle does that. We gather there, but we don't interact there. And so this gives a shared experience. And when Lilly Endowment introduced this granting opportunity, you know, hundreds of nonprofits jumped at it, and they selected eventually about 19 organizations that they could fund that were going to do this in a collective big way. And so we're thrilled to be among them.
So is that then what came first, the figure, the, hey, we have $7.6 million for this, or was that sort of negotiated? Like, this is kind of what we wanted to do? Or did Lilly say, hey, we have this, figure out something to do with it?
Lilly said dream and dream big.
Okay, and you certainly did.
And so we sharpened that pencil, and we literally brought it down to, this is to do this right and to launch this right, it'd be $7.6 million. And that's just to, you know, that puts some replenishing funds and maintenance funds in there. This is to tell arts and culture, not only through the architecture and the beauty of this space, but then also these performances and bring groups in to enjoy this space and performances and arts and cultural activities into 2020, where we're selecting nonprofits to come and do performance art on this space that might go into the evening and take advantage of this lighting and staging and sound.
Now, does this funding also sustain the installation through maintenance and utility costs?
It does on the maintenance and utility costs, but not on the content.
Hmm.
So we think about, we've also launched now just this weekend a $3 million capital campaign over the next several years to fund replenishing and renewing the video content. That's not a cheap endeavor. But we also want to pay for artists. So we're a firm believer that when we have performance art taking place, that those who are performing should be paid an equitable wage. And so some of this funding will include a fee to pay, or, you know, grants to offer to arts organizations to perform and to gather, so all of us in the community, near and far, can come and have a free experience on the circle.
Forgive me, I'm going to just play devil's advocate here. Have you gotten any raised eyebrows over this? People who have said, maybe, I don't know, this seems kind of crazy, and it is a bit of a crazy idea. I think it's going to be beautiful. I personally support it. But has anyone come forward with those kinds of concerns? Yeah,
absolutely. You know, some people complain that today's Friday. You know, there are those who are concerned about it. A legitimate concern, which we shared as well, is we don't want this to be Vegas or Times Square or Kings Island or even Disney, for that matter. We're talking about a very respectful, non-commercial presentation of history and patriotism. And you're not going to see the Coca-Cola logos flying around the circle. And we were stepping into this very cautiously in concert with the Indianapolis Historic Preservation Commission, with the state historic preservation folks, that we're doing this with respect, but we're also doing it in concert with this historical guidelines that are required for these historical districts. And so it's a wait and see. It's hey, let's test this, see what the what it looks like. We're, you know, like one of those lighting pods just to put those lights on tops of buildings. One of those buildings is a historic building, the Columbia Club down there on Monument Circle. And its placement of even lights on top of the building needs a certificate of appropriateness from the historical preservation folks. We respect that. We step through it. And sometimes their pace is not the same as our pace. We might want to be going a little more quickly, but thankfully they have the checks and balances in place to say, hey, let's do this the right way and let's do it the respectful way. And so they can somewhat, you know, not wouldn't say contain it, understand it. Lighting projection is new technology. It's what LED can do. We're seeing this more and more in other cities. This is not something we've done before. This isn't just about throwing bright lights on a monument. This is color and textures and hues and lumens. And all of this works in ways that can be spectacular. And I doubt we'll ever use the equipment to its fullest capacity, because I think that would be a little overwhelming for almost everybody.
One of the biggest annual events of the year that the Circle hosts is coming up, Circle of Lights. It's always the day after Thanksgiving when we light up the lights that IBEW 481 put up. It's kind of the official start of the holiday season downtown. How will these new improvements come into play for that event?
So we think it's still appropriate, even as we usher in the holidays, for us to remember the space in which we gather. And that space, again, is a testament to our Indiana veterans. And so there will come a moment within the celebration of Circle of Lights where we pause and we put on that patriotic display and TAPS is presented and the national anthem is presented and we gather as United Americans focused on this space that we gather. Now, that will eventually then transition into more of a holiday energy with some uplighting and some festive decor that gives that the space of almost like a snow globe because you have the surrounding elements of those buildings. And this is where we're stepping in to see what our capacity allows us to do, the additional sound and holidays feel. So when you watch the show on either our NBC affiliate WTHR here or live in person, you'll feel a sense of a much better and bigger experience because of all these lights.
All right, let's get to tomorrow night, the launch of this nightly salute. What can we expect?
So we can expect Clayton Anderson, a local country music star who's going to kind of kick us off at 4 o'clock with some energy, some country music on the Circle. We'll have our stage set up. We have some military-owned spirits and beer flowing freely out there on the Circle. We certainly are partnering with the Indiana National Guard and the U.S. Air Force just because they also want a story to share with what they do and humanitarian missions and the opportunity to tell their story. All that will be going on from 4 o'clock on. About 5 o'clock, I think you look to the sky, you might hear the national anthem, you might see a flyover. Some of that as we kind of transition into more of our patriotic presentation. And then about 5, and then the 38th Infantry Band will be playing a series of patriotic tunes along the way. And then our governor joins us on stage with his wife and their co-chairs of this event as we welcome all of the veterans who have gathered in this space and those of us who support them and turn into a little bit more of a patriotic celebration. Fanfare from the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. They've recorded the music that will play every night, but part of that symphony will have joined us on the Circle for some live presentations and the countdown to the point where it's now after dusk and we present this this first premiere of the video that then goes into TAPS in a very solemn moment and then back out of that with this energizing end. And maybe a firework or two. So this is just how we premiere this. And then from this point forward, it will be an every night experience, approximately 6:30 at night.
Shining a Light. The premiere is tomorrow night on the Circle in downtown Indianapolis. And my guest has been the Senior Vice President of Marketing and Communications for Downtown Indy, Inc., Bob Schultz. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your interest. We'll see you on the Circle.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us Monday when we'll talk about new rules proposed by the NCAA that would allow college athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can follow us for show topics and interaction. You can find me at Matt Pelser on Twitter if you like. Do me a favor and have yourself a great weekend. Thanks for listening. This is All In.